I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. I first became aware of author Andrew Sean Greer in 2003 with the publication of his second novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli. That was followed by another favorite, The Story of a Marriage, and another, The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells. His fifth book, Less, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and then he published Less is Lost. His new novel, Villa Coco, is what he calls a charm novel, a book to reread yearly as a balm to the soul. It follows a young man fresh out of college who accepts a job archiving art and artifacts at a baroness's villa in the Italian countryside. However, the job isn't what he expects it to be, and he finds himself among a unique cast of characters in an unforgettable season in Tuscany. I recently spoke with Andrew Sean Greer about Villa Coco, and here's our conversation. So before I ask for an overview of the book for our listeners, I want to talk about the type of book Villa Coco is, because my advanced reader copy opens with a letter from you. In it, you describe the charm novel and lament, you know, the lack of modern versions, resulting in a goal to write your own. Can you describe a charm novel for us?
Well, it's a very vague category. In a way, I mean, this sounds strange, but an adult novel that feels the way novels felt when we were 12, where you just want to live in them forever. And there are a lot of them, but they're from the beginning of the 20th century. It's sort of, did you ever read I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith? There's something that is, it's not a comedy or happy ending, but the charm of the narrator will take, you just want to be with her forever. And that's what I wanted to for myself. And in whatever time I was in, I was like, I just want to sink into a book and stay there and have it have an absurdity and a comedy and a magic and a kind of wisdom, like a quietly profound novel that I just, on the last page, you just hold it to your chest. A big task for a writer.
So let's go ahead and set up your charm novel. Can you give us a description of Villa Coco? What's happening here?
There's a young American who's trained as an archivist in college who, to try to get his life to be more serious, takes a vague job in rural Tuscany, working as an archivist, he thinks, for a baronessa. But he arrives and immediately finds utter chaos and everyone preventing him from archiving the chaos, and he doesn't understand anything that's going on, which leads to some misunderstandings and comedy, but also a sort of a mystery and a romance behind it of which he's not aware.
So he works for this baronessa. So let's talk a little bit about her, because she has some rules, you know, like only Italian in the car or only Italian on the boat and dress more like an Italian and what to wear to funerals. So let's talk a little bit about her life, the people she's known, the items she's collected, you know, what contributes to the chaos.
She's 92 years old when he meets her, but she is anything but frail. She has lived a gaudy life, it's clear, but it's not clear what her past really is. She seems to be a bohemian, wealthy person, but she's collected. The house is full of all these things that she refers to as junk, but that are clearly some of them very valuable, and she won't distinguish among them. And she's trying to teach him. She's very frustrated that he, as an American, doesn't understand what kind of food to eat, how to dress appropriately, or the value of things. Not meaning their cost, but their actual value, sort of in proportion to each other, and how to make a funny story out of your life.
So we know our narrator as our young man, or as, okay, help me with the pronunciation for Italian for Thursday. I don't remember.
Giovedì,
which is Giovedì. Like her man Thursday instead of a girl Friday or Crusoe's Friday. So what does she think he's there to do?
Well, of course, it's told from Giovedì's point of view, looking back many years later as an older man, that he's baffled by it. But she seems to want him. At first, she says, she comes down the stairs and he says, I'm your new archivist. And she says, oh, no, you're an American. She hears his accent and she says, this won't do. You have to leave on the next train, because for some reason, she won't have an American in the house. For whatever plot she has, it needs a British young man. But there is no next train. There's a strike on. So he's able to prove himself during the course of that day that he should remain. She needs someone she can rely on and someone who won't bore her. I think that's a lot of it. She wants to be amused by everyone around her, and that includes the people, the strange Lebanese man who works in the fields and yells everything in incomprehensible Italian. There's the Sri Lankan housemaid who is, woe begotten and ends up teaching our young man Italian. She surrounds herself with these people.
And he's instructed to bring gin and fish oil. So part of his task, I'm not going to say which one the gin is for, whether we're using gin or fish oil for this, but part of his task is to catch a creature. What is this creature?
It's a faena. I met one when I lived in rural Tuscany. It's just basically a weasel. It's a stone marten, which makes no sense, I think, to us. So I'll say it's a very British sounding thing, but it's a weasel that's been eating the chickens one by one, and they're trying to capture him. And so he's part of his job is to take part in that. And throughout the book, he works with Gazelle is the name of the, or that's what the Baronessa calls him. His name is Hazel,
You're right.
but she calls him Gazelle. And he has every few weeks a new project about how to catch this faena, all of them ridiculous.
want to talk about the Baronessa a little bit more because her name is Lisbetta or Coco. She's in her early 90s, as you mentioned, and she's just as lively as ever. Sometimes she reflects on her 70s, which I believe she calls the best time in her life. So I'm wondering how she approaches aging, and what do you think happened when she was in her 70s?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a humor to our, I think he's 21 years old, 22, to hearing someone in their 90s refer to their, oh, if only where I were in my 70s, I could do that, or I could have a romance like in my 70s. And for a 22-year-old, you think, in your 70s, but that's impossible. And it's to try to grasp how different time looks and age looks to someone much older. For instance, I'm 55, and to a 22-year-old, I'm basically 70 or 90. It's all in the haze of the distance. And I have a friend who's 100 years old, and to her, I am just a young little spring chicken who can do anything. And it's very interesting points of view. And the book is a lot about him having to change his point of view and realizing that the Baronessa sees him as a young nobody, and he slowly becomes a real person as she understands his possibilities as well.
Talk to me about her philosophy about trying things or eating things or doing things because you don't know if that's the last time you will ever be there.
Well, she's clearly an impatient person. And the first time she says that he has no clothes that are appropriate for the task at hand. And she says, we have to run to the local thrift store, which is called La Formica, the ants. And it's run by nuns. And she goes in and she finds a whole rack of a man who just died, and all of his suits are for sale and for a euro each. And our young man tries them on and they fit, but he thinks like, I can't wear an old Italian man's clothing, maybe. And he's like, I'll think about it. And she just says, we won't be back. You have to buy them now. And that comes from my philosophy when I was traveling in India with my brother, and we would go to a market, and he would say, well, I kind of like this, but I don't know. And I'm like, we're not coming back. It's a yes or no. It's not a maybe. It's like either you're buying an emerald or you're not. And if you're buying an emerald, it's going to be this one because we're not going to another emerald store. So, like, no waffling. I would say that over and over. And finally, we made our way. We were in the desert of Rajasthan, and there was a rug seller. And I was like, I'll take that one and that one. And my brother said, no, you won't, because I'm buying that one. And I thought, aha, he's picked it up.
You're listening to Marginalia. We're speaking with author Andrew Shangrier about his novel, Villa Coco. So you divide your time between San Francisco and Venice, Italy. Can you talk about the experience of living in both? Because I noted this sentence from the book. One can find the experience in America of standing where it seems no person has ever stood before, on a wilderness peak or a rocky, inaccessible shore. But seldom do we feel that thousands have stood there for thousands of years, and empires have risen and fallen and will continue to do so long after we have gone.
Well, I do want to point out how obnoxious it sounds that I live between San Francisco and Venice. I just want to say I'm married to an Italian, and so we have to, for visa reasons, we have to have two residences, and that Venice is not an expensive city compared to the other cities in Italy. Just to state that. But I do love it. I love having that different experience of living in a foreign language, in a foreign culture is the greatest challenge of my life. And it has such delights and such humiliations that I go back to it over and over. I think it's good for me. And San Francisco it was formed in 1776. That is very young for a city. And it didn't have a boom until 1850. So there was not that many people here. It's only been around 150 years. So to be in a place like Venice that was an empire for 1,000 years, unconquered, and you look every place you are has been, you can just look around as a writer and find material in something that's carved or a window or just the way the cobblestones are, how that well is in the middle of the piazza. It keeps me alive.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there were some similarities between you and our protagonist, like where you both grew up and maybe what your parents did. Did your lived experience inspire this book at all?
Yes, but only in the way that this is always a tricky thing for fiction authors, in that we steal from the real world. I especially steal from my research and people I know and experiences, and then I combine them in completely wrong ways to make the fictional world, and then I forget about the real stuff, so that people who recognize things like my mother get very frustrated. She will surely see herself and the scientists that are his parents. And I think he's from the mid-Atlantic the way I am, which I like because I find the mid-Atlantic a very funny place to be from. I find it funny to be the son of two scientists. And it's useful in this book because he needs to be very buttoned up and have been brought up in a very buttoned up environment and then released into this wild peacock-filled world where he doesn't know who he's going to be now. So I pick what I like and I leave other things behind.
I want to talk about the food a little bit, and I'm sure I'm supposed to say, what is it, buono? Buono.
Buono!
So the descriptions were just mouth-watering, you know, from olive oil to truffles. And there's this quote, "Everything I had tasted in America, everything Italian, was a distant memory of the old country, like a spell written down but never heard. Of course, some enchantment was lost." So did you enjoy capturing this taste of Italy for us?
My editor said, we can never have enough description of food or animals or countryside. And I thought, okay, I'll just lay it on because I like to cook, and cooking in Italy is really interesting because it's so regional and so seasonal. And so my husband, who's Italian, will tell me, even here in America, I will want to buy clementines, and he'll say, "But it's June. Are you out of your mind? It's the time to buy peaches, even though they're available. It's not time. The time is over to eat them. You had your moment. Let it go. Move on to peaches and cherries." And that's something as an American that's hard to learn. But then you learn the pleasure of when it is there, you enjoy it thoroughly, and then you let it go.
As I mentioned earlier, our narrator is known through his nicknames. We learn his real name in the final pages of the book. Talk to me about this timing. Why wait to reveal?
Well, it's one of those things that I feel like belongs in what I'm calling a charm novel. These little bits of, like, we don't know his name, like those old books you would read that would begin with, like, Madam M underline arrived at the city of P underline at 12 p.m. And you just think, why are they doing that? It actually makes it feel more real because they're hiding the truth. And so I'm imitating that in a way. And then I realized, oh, well, he isn't really. He's a young person who's a little unshaped. And at the end of the book, when we learn his real name, he's sort of become himself. That can give a sort of structure to the book and a kind of, I think, a little pleasure to the reader to be like, oh, I should have guessed that was his name.
This might be more of an inside baseball question, but I listened to the audiobook as I read the physical advanced reader copy. And as I read, I would note some differences between what was on the page and what was in my ear. And I'm assuming that the finished audio aligns with the finished print copy of the book, but it made me curious. When are your final edits due?
They are due. I mean, there are many passes of copy edits, especially something where so much is in a foreign language with foreign concepts. They have to be checked over and over. So I forget when I turned in my final one, December maybe. Now, this is so different from Italy, where they publish 2 weeks after you turn something in. It goes like that. But in the United States, they're very diligent. But I will say the narrator of the audiobook, who I really fought to have, Edoardo Ballerini, is the best audiobook narrator, and he's Italian. So this book was just right up his alley. So I don't like to listen to my books after I've written them, but I really am looking forward to hearing him, because to hear his take on all these accents is going to be, I just think, a hoot.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Villacoca? I mean, is this the charm novel you hoped it would be?
Well, you never know what you've written, but I hope so. I hope that they leave with sort of gasping at the end, with I hope a bit of happiness and a surprise. It's the ending is not exactly what you're expecting, and a sense of possibility about what life is about. I hope that there's a little wisdom from this difficult, marvelous elderly baronessa that makes its way through, so that at the end you're totally smitten with her. Because in a way, that's what the book is about, to fall in love with this person and the possibilities that she offers him.
We've talked about a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I didn't ask?
Well, you talked about food. That's my favorite thing. No, I think that there's a little adventure and mystery and romance and humor. And I hope, as you asked, I hope in the end, delight.
Well, the book is Villa Coco. Andrew Shongrier, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Villa Coco by Andrew Shongrier was published by Doubleday. Joining us now is David Enyart, manager at Next Chapter Booksellers in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to Marginalia, David.
You too. Hello.
So what books do you want to talk about today? What are folks reading in St. Paul? Any trends that you see?
I am very interested in the trends I'm seeing in fiction in our store over the past couple of years. My store is pretty normal in that about half our sales are fiction. And for years, that's meant literary fiction, as it's called. I think you can hear the quotes. But there's been real growth in the last several years about what people call genre fiction. And I think that's a really interesting view into what people are reading and maybe why.
So what are some of the types of genre fiction that you see?
So genre fiction, the sort of, I don't know, people find it a little slighting, but the term for fiction that's not reviewed in the New York Times very often. For a long time, that meant mystery fiction, maybe thrillers and that sort of thing. And people are still reading that for sure. But there's been a lot of growth in other types of fiction. So romance, for example. Horror is a big one at the moment. Sci-fi and fantasy generally. Manga, you could call that a different kind of fiction, or you could call it a different format entirely, a different medium entirely. But books that are not novels about marriages falling apart on the Upper West Side, and that's an unfair characterization of literary fiction. But those sorts of genres have seen real growth among readers. And I don't know if it's the chicken or the egg, but they've seen a real push from publishers as well in the past several years.
So earlier you said literary fiction and you put it in quotes, but how do you define literary fiction and especially compared to some of this other genre fiction?
That's a tough one. A lot of genres have very clear sort of rules to them, right? So romance readers will not allow you to call a book a romance if it does not have a happy ending. That's really sort of the strictest one I can think of. But sci-fi and its various flavors tend to have a lot of technology. They tend to have a lot of speculation about alternatives. Some of them are in whole different planets and worlds. Literary fiction doesn't have that strict definition, right? It can be extremely realistic. It can be extremely formally inventive. It could be nothing but a single sentence for 600 pages. It could be four words on a page for 8 pages and call it done. So, in some ways, literary fiction is your catch-all, your default, which is how we've talked about it for years. But I think the marketing of literary fiction does kind of mark it out as a genre in that there's a particular kind of reader, there's a particular kind of conversation that you have about literary fiction that people don't always have, or don't have first anyway, about genre fiction. Things like structure and vocabulary and things like that that aren't necessarily people's first concerns when they're reading genre fiction.
Do you have any titles that you want to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. My genre of choice is either the police procedural, which is a specific kind of mystery, I guess you'd say. Usually there's less mystery about it, and it's more about the setting and the tone. And what I really love is a good spy novel. But what I'm reading currently is called The Dentist by Tim Sullivan. It's the first in the D.S. George Cross series of mysteries. In many ways, it's a very standard police procedural of a type, right? The protagonist is a 50-year-old man. His relationships with his family aren't especially good. His career is sort of stalling out, but he's smarter than everybody else and he's going to solve the mystery. And so they can't get rid of him or ignore him. And the thing that's new about this one, this series, is that the hero is autistic. He's on the spectrum. So there really is a reason he's rubbing people the wrong way. It's a lot about watching the people around him react to that, respond to that, use him and his focus to solve a murder, usually, solve a crime. And he's kind of abrasive. So it's a little interesting twist on that one. And then, honestly, after that, it's reasonably straightforward. This is a part of the genre that you can see a lot. This is Ian Rankin. This is Arnold Durandrieveson. This is so many people have this 50-ish character, right? And that's one of the consolations of genre fiction is you know what you're going in for, and it lets you focus on the little things around the edges that are different. What this author does better than your average author. What that author doesn't do within those confines. I love this series for the reasons that people love genre fiction. It's familiar, but also new. I can read one and then turn around and read another one pretty soon afterwards and know what I'm getting.
Oh, so any other titles or genres or series you're excited about?
I love spy novels. I love the twisty moral ambiguity. I love the mysteries. I think in many ways a good spy novel is an even twistier mystery because it's not just who done it, it's who did this and this and this and why and when. And there are a couple that I like. I really, really like the Slow Horses novels, Mick Herron's. I've been talking about him for years. Those are fantastic. He's a really good novelist. He tells you everything once. They're deceptively simple, but you really have to pay attention. And he's just a very skilled novelist. There's a point in one of his later novels, a scene where the target is moving through a park. Three different pairs of agents are converging on this park from different directions. And he cuts back and forth between all of them over about 8, 10, 12 pages. And you never lose track of who's where. You're not thinking about the craft at the time, but when you get to the end, you realize this thing is crazy. Like you followed the whole thing for 12 pages and you know where everybody is. That's one you definitely need to read in order. So Slow Horses is the first one, and I would start there. And then I love a series of novels that was reissued a couple years ago by Len Deighton. Len Deighton died recently, and if you want a good time, go back and read his obituary because he had a crazy interesting life. A lot of it in advertising, it turns out. But he met all sorts of people, and he was one of those folks who just did what he wanted to do. And thank goodness, one of the things he wanted to do was write these spy novels. It's a trio of trios. The first one is, let's see, Berlin Game, Mexico Set, London Match. And they follow a spy in Britain in the 70s. It's the height of the Cold War. Britain's not really doing very well. Our hero, Bernard, is a little lower class than everybody else in his office, and they don't let him forget it. And everybody's playing everybody. He has a huge catalog, but the spy novels are really, really good. And they were criminally out of print, or at least unavailable for a very long time, but they're back. So Len Deighton's Berlin Game is an excellent, excellent place to start. And yeah, again, as with genre fiction, you can just read one and turn right around and read the next one, and it's going to be just as good for you, which is what people like about genre fiction, I think.
You know, our guest on today's show earlier was Andrew Shangrier about his novel Villa Coco. And he said, he wrote a little letter in the beginning of the advanced reader copy that I had, where he said his goal was to write a charm novel because he didn't think we had enough charm novels in this generation. First of all, do you think that is a genre that, you know, might be sectioned out in the bookstore? But are there other novels that fit that genre?
That's interesting. I don't myself read charming novels. I don't like being charmed, but I get it. And
I'm trying to laugh silently.
I enjoy being charmed. I can't think of a lot of other novels like that. I would say Gentleman in Moscow was probably a charm novel. I think we underestimate the value of being charmed by a book. I think literary fiction, some of the marketing will sort of emphasize the difficulty, the challenge. And I love difficulty and challenge in reading sometimes, but I think we underestimate the value of being charmed, of reading a novel by an author who's really writing for the audience, who's really conscious of the reader's experience. And clumsy hands that feel sort of ham-fisted, and you're being led to this conclusion and not trusted to understand what's happening, and so you have to be spoon-fed, and that I don't enjoy. But a really gifted novelist will, work the magic really well, right? Distract you over here, entertain you here, but always moving you towards the point they want to make. That feels great, right? To be coddled and attended to is really fun. I love a novel that pays attention to the reader and brings them through the book the way the author wants, and gets to the end that the author wrote and literally decided, but makes you feel happy that you were taken on that journey. So I love a good charm novel from a good charming author. In the right hands, that's just fun. That's what we call it, a page turner. That's a book that you want to read. And what's better than a book you want to read?
Well, you have given us a lot to think about. This
I
conversation
do
has
like to talk.
this conversation has been edited for time, but you can find all of David's recommendations at kmuw.org. David Inyart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.